You know, when I say content community commerce, the idea is that these are the three tenets that help create a social community or an social community is a new thing, but a digitally connected community on the internet space either comes to consume content or comes for commerce or comes for community. So the community tools were internet and, you know, were the email, chat and other such things. We did have a shopping cart also at WebDunya, and we did event-based shopping. And our balance sheet will show that we did make at least 7-8% revenue every year from commerce that we were doing online. And then, of course, the content.
Hello and welcome to the Indian Dream Podcast, co-hosted by Sahil and Siddharth. On this show, we highlight the journeys of successful entrepreneurs who've built profitable businesses and attempt to learn more about what it takes to build one. Each week, Sahil and I will interview one such entrepreneur and learn something unique from their journey. Before I talk about the episode today, I want to take a moment and pray for everyone who is going through tough times. It's hard times for all of us, and we need to do what it takes to ride this wave out. Take care of your physical and mental health. Hoping this podcast can help you distract from the gloomy times we're living in. Stay in and stay safe, folks. Let's jump to the episode today. It's always fascinating to talk to an entrepreneur who's had a long and interesting journey of building multiple businesses. We hosted Mr. Vinay Chajlani, who has been an entrepreneur for more than 3 decades and has created multiple profitable businesses. In this fascinating journey, he's seen it all. Success, failure, venture capital funding, bootstrapping your way to profit, exit, he has truly seen it all. Let me summarize the companies that he has created. Strap your seatbelts on, because he's had some journey. After graduating in late 1980s, he joined his family business of newspaper publishing, which had a newspaper under the name of Nayi Duniya circulating in Indore. After not getting the freedom to express himself and explore new ideas, he decided to quit it and start an IT services firm on his own. Now bear in mind, this is late 80s and early 90s when computers weren't prevalent. Yet, he built a profitable business sitting out of Indore and took it global by serving US clients. That business continues to run profitably till date and is now focused on providing tech products to high-end jewelers in the US. Around 1999, after handing over the reins of his IT services business to his team, he started WebDunya to explore the world of vernacular products and services built on the internet. He built the world's first email service in Hindi, created tools to enable content publishing in Hindi and other regional languages, and even built a community and commerce play. He went on to raise capital from Silicon Valley venture capitalists. He went on to raise capital from Silicon Valley venture capitalists and even raised a second round from International Finance Corporation just post the dot-com bubble. The story gets really interesting when part of the tranche never came through and he had to pivot overnight to make sure the company could be cash flow positive. And he sure did. He attempted the holy trinity of content, community, commerce back in 2000. In hindsight, an idea before its time. To put this in context, this has been attempted by a few startups in the last few years with some degree of success. We go through this journey in detail on the episode. WebDunya was acquired last year by a global company, giving the business a successful exit. In 2006 and 2007, after steadying the ship at WebDunya, life came a full circle for him. The family business of newspaper publishing was struggling as the industry had evolved in the last decade or so. With the help of outside investors, he bought the business and scaled it across cities and states over the next few years before a successful exit to Dainik Jagran in 2012-13. He started multiple other businesses which never took off, including a cable television business, a jewelry e-commerce business in 2001, and a real estate project in the late 2010s. In fact, the real estate project was one of his biggest failures in terms of financial impact. We talk about his learnings from these businesses in the episode. What I find fascinating is his ability to jump into different businesses and getting a successful outcome. We talk about the principles and values that he has used across these businesses, the role of spirituality in business, and how he has navigated his son's introduction in the family business, given the challenges that he faced when he entered the family business back in 1980s. So grateful that I got a chance to talk to him and learn from his journey. We start off the conversation by talking about his journey of building DiaSpark, which was the IT services business, and moving on to starting WebDunia. With that, let's jump to the episode and hear from him.
So somewhere in the end of 97, beginning of 98, when we started to have decent revenue streams and regular income and profitability in our business at DiaSpark, and towards the end of 96, to be honest with you, we started to look at onboarding somebody who could head DiaSpark in the US. And I was practically living out of a suitcase with close to 115 days every year in the US, a young family in India. It was a toil. And while the business was good, it wasn't something that was very challenging in terms of the development and the technical work we were really doing, in terms of, you know, are we solving a real problem other than bringing good bread and butter revenue, and if we get a good project, adding a creamy layer to it. So and we did, by the way, and before I get to WebDunia, and we did start in DiaSpark at that time also an investment into a software product for the jewelry industry, but there was a team in place, and in fact the team leadership remains the same from 96 till today. The same person is still heading that team. He's become a brand in himself in the jewelry IT industry. So Vinod is the name of the person, and Vinod Jain and I spoke, and I said, Vinod, you know, I really want to do something more meaningful, you know, and one of the things, because of the background of Naidunia that was always dear to me, was the support for Indian languages in the technology space, because that was one of the bottlenecks we were always facing when we were buying any publishing software tool for Naidunia, that the support for Hindi would be limited, or at best it would be a fix. It would not be an ingenious or a native support built into the software product. So whether it was a story editing, whether it was, you'd be surprised that in 98 there was no spell checker for Hindi. So if you're using a story in Hindi, there was no spell checker. So there had to be a lot of efforts on manual proofreading. So I think the first problem that we tried to solve was, if you want to learn about what are the nuances of managing an Indian language environment in a computer science environment, is it just the human machine interface, which is the keyboard and the display, or is it more basic? Is it the support? So, you know, in those days, ASCII was the basic character set, and we had the QWERTY keyboard. In order to understand what the nuances is, the first thing we try to do is, why don't we try to build a spell checker for Naidunia, and we'll do it free of cost. And that was an interesting thing, because we went to a company called Monotype, which had basically provided us the data entry, or the, you know, the DTP software that we were using at Naidunia. And we said, we want to build a spell checker which will integrate into this. And, you know, they didn't understand. They said, our software comes from London, our company is headquartered in London, and there's no way we can give you access to the software. So what we did is, we reverse engineered their file storage. What we did is, we actually read their file offline in another. So you could compose a story, save it, then open the spell checker software, open the file, and it will keep highlighting the words that were going wrong. So at least if we could not spell correct, we could at least spell check. We could identify the wrong words. And for creating a dictionary of right words, we took the proofread files of Naidunia, and for 10 days took all the stories that Naidunia had created, and, you know, populated a database looking at unique words that had not already featured into our database. So we were able to create from a 10-day master list. And in our software, then we had a provision that if our software said this word is wrong, the editor could go and say, no, it is right. If he said it was right, it would automatically get added back. So basically, the spell checker was doing two things. It was building a dictionary of, or a listing of, all the correct words as how they are spelled in Hindi. And it would point out to the proofreader. So instead of manually proofreading, the computer was helping him proofread faster. And Naidunia actually was able to do their proofreading much more efficiently using our tool. So that was first. With that, we moved into the next phase, that by that time, you know, the emails had started, and, you know, AOL online and CompuServe and these systems had started. VSNL had started to give email accounts in India. So we said, you know, we had editors in Naidunia who could not speak English. That means they could never. right? But they were brilliant people. So the immediate next thought was, how can we create a module that will allow people to create an email and send it in Hindi? So we launched in February, March of 1999, a service called ePatra. So it's the exact translation of email. Mail means patra and e. So we launched a service called ePatra. And, you know, it was instantly accepted. The very next day, the DD Metro Aajtak program carried it in the morning in their news that, you know, there's a company in Indore that's going to allow you to send your email in Hindi free, and that soon they'll allow you to send it in all Indian languages. There was only one problem, though, that we could only send mails. We didn't have a full mail service, right? So we were using the MAPI platform, MAPI protocol, only to send mails. So we didn't have an inbox. We didn't have, you know, so your in mail would come into your original folder. But we solved one of the problems, which is you could send mails. So that was the beginning of getting more, you know, more entrenched and more in love with solving this problem of bringing Indian language support on technology platform.
Interesting. And then you also went on to raise money from, you know, venture capital investors from the Silicon Valley to solve this problem of taking vernacular language, starting with Hindi, and building products and services around that, right? This was, again, 99.
So when we cracked the ePatra sending piece, our immediate next product roadmap was to have a full stack email service at ePatra.com.
Right, right.
And at the same time, the thought was that standalone email will not survive. You need to build an entire environment for people to understand that Hindi or Indian languages can be supported. So then there and then started the work on a product called Web Dunya. And we coined the term somewhere in April of 1999. Again, Web Dunya becoming Web World. So webdunya.com. And we started working on a full stack portal. And 23rd September 1999 at the India Internet World, we launched the webdunya.com portal. And it came with a full stack email companion product called ePatra and a full stack chat product called eVarta. So there were three products we launched there. And you have to understand that to launch Web Dunya, to publish the content, we also had to create the content, right? We also built the backend CMS tool for that. And all the problems that we were facing at Nai Duniya, we wanted to solve when we went into digital publishing. So when we built our own CMS, so we didn't rely on anybody else to provide us the CMS. We wrote our own CMS and we used it to publish the stories. And until date, we continue to use our own CMS. So the version of the CMS that we use is an evolution of what we first wrote. And, you know, it has evolved over a period of time.
Nice. And this is when you launched this portal is when you attracted the eyeballs from investors saying, we want to participate in this.
Absolutely. So between September and March, in the 6 months, we had a merchant banker on board.
This is 99, right around the dot-com bubble.
It was still the boom time.
2000, 2001 is when the bubble sort of popped.
Yeah, I think 2000... October, November is when Yahoo took a big hit in NASDAQ, and that's when the bubble really started to burst.
Interesting. How did that impact you?
That was the time we were getting ready for a second round. And you know, in between, we had a couple of offers to acquire. And like every young entrepreneur and a large VC that backs such an entrepreneur in the boardroom, our talk was, no, this is not the value we are taking. We are worth far more. This tip of the iceberg. And it seems a no-brainer that in a country where only 6% people speak English, if we can crack the language, content, community, commerce, secret or the connection, we're a billion-dollar company. So
this bit on content, community, commerce and the vernacular thing, आपने उस टाइम पे अटेम्प्ट किया वो सॉल्व करने के लिए एंड वील गेट टू व्हाट हैपेंड आफ्टर दैट बट देयर वाज अ गुड 10-15 इयर्स वेयर नोबडी रियली अटेम्प्टेड इट अगेन इट्स ओनली इन द लास्ट फ्यू इयर्स दैट वी आर सीइंग
this whole, you know, focus on vernacular, focus on content, community, commerce. But I want to go deeper into your thought process on content, community, commerce. Why do you think these three things work together?
So, I mean, that is the whole play of internet, right? I mean, I know this is not, it's an audio platform. I wish it was an interactive AR, VR platform. I could still share with you the first business report we presented to Walden, which caught their eye. And I think for the 20 years thereafter, we did nothing different from the business report. I mean, the numbers could be different, but the set of activities that we outlined as the basic building blocks of this industry, where we said we're not a content company, we're not a tech company, we're not a services company, but we are all put together. So we are a small ecosystem within ourselves. You know, it's like Bhutan existing as a happy country, right? It's an ecosystem in itself, not a large company, but it's a happy company. So we're building a happy company that was in a niche space of its own, but had all the components that are required for a state to operate or for an organization. You know, when I say content, community, commerce, the idea is that these are the three tenets that help create a social community or an social community is a new thing, but a digitally connected community on the internet space either comes to consume content or comes for commerce or comes for community. So the community tools were internet and, you know, were the email, chat and other such things. We did have a shopping cart also at WebDunya, and we did event-based shopping. And our balance sheet will show that we did make at least 7-8% revenue every year from commerce that we were doing online. And then, of course, the content.
Content was the anchor to get people in first. Community is how they sort of stick together, and commerce is how they find value in the entire platform.
So the other thing we were trying to do at this time is also, you know, the reason we hired a guy from Discovery or National is he would have the network and a reach to the top marketeers to go and sell the concept. And interestingly, in those days, we signed brands like Safola, Godrej, HDFC, ICICI, Amul to advertise with us on our platform. As direct sales. So we were able to monetize. Of course, the monies were not good enough. Monies are not even good enough for even a lot of the publishers today. So forget 20 years. People are bleeding in the content and community space or even the commerce space today. And I think that's where we got hit with the bubble being burst. So, and you're right. It took 15 years for people to realize that, you know, a Paisa Bazaar or a Flipkart or so many such properties, or, you know, all the OTT platforms largely that have, you know, that are making money now are having to go to regional languages. There's no other choice.
Yeah. In a country of 1.3 billion people, as you said, a very small percentage is English speaking, right? So if you want to cater to this, to this population, you have to go vernacular. That's where the real, commerce and GDP really happens.
There are two things that failed us, right? In the early 2000s, there was a great report that everybody in the internet space followed, and so did we. It was called the Goldman Sachs report. Talk about significant rise in the connectivity in the Indian diaspora, and not just in A town or B town, but in C towns. By the year 2006. And those numbers were our, you know, guiding light in terms of what was the potential that we were trying to address. But the penetration of the internet using wired or a wireline connectivity did not really happen. It did not transpire there. Right? India continued to be out of the top 100 nations in terms of the data consumption and the availability of data networks. That problem only got solved in the 14, 15, 16 timeframe when, you know, Jio and the 4G broadband and, you know, along with the Jio bandwagon came the, you know, came the Airtels and Vodafones, and everybody got into 4G. And where people experienced internet for the first time using handheld devices or, you know, wireless devices.
Yeah, we skipped the complete broadband connectivity, the wired connectivity as a country.
And in a sense, WebDunya was preparing for that generation to come on board, which never happened. So for a long time, our sustenance was on people for whom Indian language was a second choice. They were first choice English users. And they had a fancy for or a relatively secondary need for consuming language on the internet in whatever form. I think that is where we possibly did not get the right traction. There was no tailwind that was pushing us in that direction in terms of the infrastructure being available.
Correct. And as the bubble popped, I would imagine getting follow-on funding at that point in time would have been a steep hill to climb.
Well, so we did raise a second round in the year 2001, December, actually.
This is when IFC came on board.
When IFC came on board and Times Internet came on board.
Interesting. So 2001, too, I was speaking to the founder of Ferns and Petals just yesterday, and they launched their own online portal back in 2001, 2002. And I was asking, ki, ye idea kahan se aaya? Like, how did you realize that flowers could be sold online? And he mentioned that they were vendors to indiatimes.com, and the kind of business that they started seeing through indiatimes.com made them realize, oh, this is going to be huge. So even then, 2001, 2002, it's not like commerce wasn't happening. People were going to the internet and making commerce happen. It was just that it was a very small percentage of what, you know, could have been in 2005, 6 if things panned out right. At some point, I think in 2002, 3, you pivoted to more services than the product vision that you had.
Yep. So I think wo kehte na ki majboori ka naam Mahatma Gandhi. So I think the investors, which is IFC and Combine, in 2002 July sometime, I think they were jittery whether their money will ever create value, and we were confident, so we were not seeing the same value in the work that we were doing, and there were certain conditions for their follow-on tranches which as a matter of principle I was not agreeable to. And they decided not to invest their second and third tranche, which also meant that either we had to find a way to make ends meet or we had to shut down the company. So, but at that time, we had already cracked one big account in India. And that was a service account, and that was Reliance Infocom. And I'm very thankful that I actually made that crack, because they wanted to have a complete web, like an internet product environment on their handheld device, which was multilingual. And we were already now a part of that solutioning. So we were seeing revenue traction and services from them. And we had been promised more and more. Take whatever work you can do. So I think rather than compromising on the conditions and giving up our identity and the direction, which we did have to give, but at least in our own control, and therefore not having enough money to invest further on intellectual properties, which were not going to produce revenues down for foreseeable future. We said that if we don't raise money, we can still, do all the right things, and it'll take us about 90 days and we'll turn profitable. We dropped almost all of our product initiatives and new research and new development initiatives. Pivoted all our expertise and energy into client services. And in client services, I think even if you're half smart, you cannot lose money, because you'll always make X plus.
Yeah. So
we pivoted and we moved very quickly into, services industry. And obviously we didn't realize the potential that we were after, but we made a company that could survive. Company that could still focus on languages, and company that has stayed afloat till date.
That's the key part, right? I think as you get more external funding, the founder optionality keeps reducing, where it's not on you to say ki main ab services kar leta. It still happened early enough for you where you could sort of take a step back and go back to the drawing board, but once you're 2, 3, 4 rounds of funding in, you don't have that optionality on how you want to grow that company, through profitability or through other means, right? And in your case, it happened early enough where you said, let me take a step back and let me focus on services because they are profitable. And Reliance, I mean, basis whatever they've done, they've catered to the true India for everything that they've gotten into, right? They've never been a mass, they've never been a niche, you know, English speaking play. They've always been, how do I take my products and services to the masses? So it kind of makes sense that they were focused on multilingual support when their phones came out back in the day. This was, they had something called as
Monsoon Hangama.
Our world.
We were a large part of the R world development because R world was totally language based. It had all the Indian languages. It has some 65, 67 apps the first time it was launched. And each app was supported in all Indian languages.
Wow. So you, through this time, had basically created that positioning for yourself and Web Dunya as anything related to tech and vernacular. You were the go-to person during those times.
I'd like to believe so. Yes. sometimes in hindsight, good things happen. Fate brings good things for you. And I'll say that because you can see that IFC has come and we had raised money and we would have continued our product development. And internet never happened in 2005-06 as was projected. Possibly would have been left high and dry, not knowing where to go from there. But having pivoted to doing, you know, so we signed clients like Rediff. We went and sold our email solution to Rediff, that you can have Rediff mail as Indian language mail. We sold the same Times of India, that Times internet mail can be supported in Indian languages. So we started to monetize a lot of the work we had put in. We sold CMS solutions to a lot of language publishers. That, you know, you can take your Chitralekha magazine in Gujarati can now go online if you use our CMS. Or, you know, if Malayalam Manorama had bought a CMS that was not supporting Malayalam as well, we said, you know, take away their Malayalam support. We will help you bring a Malayalam support that will make it work better. We created a corpus of several thousand sentences of parallel translation between English and
Hindi. Right.
We were able to monetize these by selling it to Microsoft Research Lab, IBM Research Lab, Google, because they were starting to look at, in the year 2006-07, machine-based translation for Indian English to Hindi. And as a training, NLP training, they needed large corpuses. And we had already invested in a structured corpus. So while we never got into machine-based translation ourselves.
Right.
So they were producing.
We enabled the others.
We had the data that would help the technology fructify better. So we
interesting.
We would find ways to make money. You know.
Yeah. And you kind of, as you rightly pointed out, you continue to do so till date, till the exit happened last year. We'll get to that later. But you were able to make sure the company survived and survived on its own capabilities of profits that were going back into the company, right? That's phenomenal. That entire Web Dunya story was phenomenal. I want to shift gears to another stint in your career where you left tech. You know, talking to you, it doesn't seem like you would do anything but tech. But there was a brief period in your entire career where you did nothing close to technology, and you made that a great outcome also. I would love to go into that story when you went back to run Nayi Duniya and how you sort of grew Nayi Duniya from what it was when you took over and the eventual exit that happened.
So destiny. I left my engineering, basic engineering, to go do printing, to get into Nayi Duniya. Got back into engineering or software. And I think after 18 years, right, came back into Nayi Duniya. So in 2006, I think Nayi Duniya was going through a bit of a struggle because we had largely become a single edition newspapers. The entire landscape in publishing industry had changed. And multi-edition newspapers were doing well. From pure play journalism, newspapers had become a distribution game and monetization of eyeball game, right? So, you know, earlier we talk about how reputable a newspaper is to now how big a newspaper is. And I think possibly we stuck too close to our values of journalism as a family and as a group. And in some sense, that hindered with our growth in terms of circulation numbers, advertising revenues. So when that happened, actually, you know, there were a lot of restructuring thought processes going on in the company. We had offers from one of the large publishing houses to become a partner. And at that time, I was able to, with help of a very close, I would say with help of a friend and an immense well-wisher, able to tie up capital to get into Naidunia with the condition that I actually start to run it. I think I took to Naidunia like the old cliche that like a, you know, fish takes to swimming. Probably, you know, being a part of a publishing house ever since childhood, you understand the nuances, you understand the business. I had been educated to know about newspaper production, and through Webdunia, the content part of it, I was quite, you know, the entire content structure of Webdunia was designed by me, the segmentation, the weekly analysis of readership patterns and, you know, what is consumed, what is not consumed. So I think it helped having done Webdunia portal helped me in being better prepared for Naidunia. Also gave me a different outlook. You could put editors to task by monitoring their production and contribution. You could decide which stories make sense and why. And general management, I think you pick up. So for 6 years, you know, so we had a long call between all our different, you know, the management team at Webdunia, the management team at Diaspark, that, you know, this is something I will have to do and this is something I want to give it a shot. I mean, I owe this to the institution to give it a shot, fair bit of shot. So I think after a long 2-3 hour call between all of us, and it meant that others had to take over the responsibility of what I was doing in the company. And I think that worked out well. I moved into Naidunia, I think, in March of 2006.
Yeah.
And yeah. Then for 6 years, it was all, it was one way. It was a nice growth story. We went to, from Indore, the first place we went to was Raipur. We went to Jabalpur, Bhopal, Ujjain, Bilaspur, and eventually we started an edition in Delhi. So we were sub 100,000 copies when I took over, and when we exited in 2012, and then Jagran Prakashan Limited bought out Naidunia, we had reached about 650,000. So 650% growth in 6 years, I think, not a bad story. We had created a footprint, revenues had started to go up. If you leave aside our dream project of Delhi, where it was costing us a bomb, I think more or less we had almost gotten to break even in the Madhya Pradesh Chhattisgarh area.
This is where I want to talk about the principles and values, right? Because as an entrepreneur, when you see somebody go to different industries and get favorable outcomes through grit, through perseverance, through determination, of not sort of not accepting that failure, right? I think Webdunia, you had a chance when the funding transit happened that you said, hey, this is not going to work out. And I'm just going to, you know, not do this. I'm going to call it a failure. I think you've not had that moment up till Naidunia, where a lot of the principles and values is what I want to focus on what made you take, what made you work, what were some things that were non-negotiable to you when it came to business, things like those.
There are a few things we will start with. Okay. I just out of curiosity, I was reading some of my old school reports, third grade and fourth grade. So each semester, the teacher in Hindi, you know, I went to Balvinay Mandir in Indore, would put in Hindi, you know, traits, right? Pravatti. So in all the first semester final of third and fourth grade, the two class teachers have put in Pravatti Jigyasu. So I've always been a curious kid or a curious person. And I think that continues. So I can, if I'm sitting at a dermatologist's office, I'll not pick up a news magazine. I'll pick up the dermatology magazine. Dentist, I'll pick up the magazine that the dentist has about dentistry. Now, I think that's where I add more value to myself by learning more about the subject that I am here for. Right? Because then I know what questions I have to ask the dentist when he's doing something on me. So that is one. And the other thing is, I'm not somebody who likes to quit. It's not about, I think, you know, and you and I connected on Vipassana, and you know, they say that nothing is permanent, anitya. In business also, nothing is permanent. So if there's a bad time today, if you can sustain it, it's got to turn around and become, you know, so it's a sine curve. Life is a sine curve. At the end of the day, you get the root mean square. Right? So the problem is, if I'm very happy at the top, then somewhere, even if it's down, somewhere even before it's zero, I will actually start to give up. Forget the negative. But I know if the resultant of all this is going to be the root mean square of my life, or of this enterprise that I'm doing, right, will eventually lead to some positive root mean square. I think that mathematics works very well in my life. But again, you also have to put a stop loss. There are a couple of ventures that I've given up, where I've realized that it's not about sustenance, but it's already about defining a stop loss at the very beginning. That, you know, in this venture, this is what I'm going to sustain. I can't sustain beyond. I don't have the means to sustain. But the serious businesses that I've personally been involved with, I think I have rarely ever given up. I want to hang in there, and I want to try. I want to give it my best shot. And I think when you have that belief, you will automatically get a team that has that belief. And if you and the team together have that belief, and you don't start lying to your own self, you don't start cheating yourself. So it's good to say we are in trouble, right? So if it's like, you know, wild water rafting, and you say the currents have become very strong, and I think this raft is kind of out of our control. If all of us start lying to each other, it's going to topple. All of us align and say, okay, guys, the next three bends are difficult, but there is no shore around the place where we can bank this raft. The only choice is we need to create our weights and balances in such a way so that we don't topple over. So when the currents are opposite, you all move to the other side. So I think that transparency and faith and delegation with the right empowerment, these are my basic principles of trying to build a team. And I think then if you build a good team that's true to the mission that you're at, I think you can go through bad times and build a company.
I often hear this, right? A job of a CEO or a leader in an organization is to make sure the team has good resources, make sure the team is smart and capable. And the third thing is to get out of the way and let them operate, right? And I think you've been able to do this across different organizations. What's fascinating is some of these organizations you've not actively been a part of, but they've successfully, you know, stood the test of time. And both the organizations, WebDunya and DieSpark, continue to run today. You know, even though that you went and did something else with NaiDunya in the middle, that's a testament of the team that you had built in these organizations. Okay, the stop loss bit. Take me through. You know, give me one example where you had to look at the stop loss and say, "This is it. I need to get out of it."
So one small one, one big one. Started in 2001, a company called Gemlinks. That was in the business of creating an e-commerce platform for the jewelry industry. So there were two other partners in the family. And we had set a budget of a particular amount, and at best a 10% contingency. And we did hope that we'll probably be able to raise money. While we got a good product going, we set up an office in New York City to unload, you know, to upload inventory from different people. We hired a person there who go and get, you know, we had to convince people to post their inventories online for e-commerce to happen. It was largely a B2B platform in those days, not a B2C. With an option to do B2C in future. But I think we eventually reached a point and where we said we're not able, and you know, the dot-com bubble burst, we were not able to raise money. And we were not seeing any traction, and we knew that even if we triple this money, four times this money, nothing is going to happen. We kind of exited. So we knew Gemlinks had a future, but we were only a small, you know, other than the founders, we were only a team of two people. So there was not much at stake, and possibly we didn't have courage and the pockets enough to go through with the next 3-4 years. We shelved it. And interestingly, the younger brother of one of the founders, Mithun Sacheti, in a different form with his own efforts and his own concepts, launched a company called Carrot Lane, right? And we all know what Carrot Lane is today. So anybody that's an entrepreneur and is following up the entrepreneurial and the VC space in India knows the success story that Carrot Lane is, right? So I'm very happy that, you know, somebody in the family itself picked up the same idea, found a more suitable version of it to work, a better architecture, a better product design, a better business model around the same concept. And it's a runaway success today. So, yes, we did stop that. You know, that's one good example. I launched a cable television network in Indore in the year 91, but I realized that it was illegally very swampy space to be in and just get sucked in. It took me only 6 months to realize that, got out. So for a different reason, I got out of that space. But we all know what the cable network is today. So, you know, I wish we'd lasted, had the courage to go through some swampy terrain. I did not have that. So I'm usually very afraid of being on the wrong side of the law, or, you know.
This was a complete cash game, right? This was complete cash collections.
No, not only that. There was no law that allowed you to put cable fiber.
Oh, interesting.
Right. So in those days, we were putting the coaxial cable. There was no law that allowed anybody other than the Post and Telegraph Department to lay cable.
Interesting.
I did have a real estate venture. We had a hospitality property, a large one, one of the best convention properties in the country. It was operating in the brand of the Grand Bhagwati. That was another big decision point for me in life, where, you know, sucking in a lot of capital and a lot of money. Business was growing, but on papers and then through hiring of a hospitality consultant, I could categorically see that there's nowhere close to cash break-even for the next 3 to 4 years. And even that would not happen on the back of the operator. It would only happen on the back of one of the founders or the partners of the business getting in full-time and, you know, getting your hands and legs dirty to actually understand the industry, do the job. We did hire a hospitality consultant to know. I was starting to take a lot of sessions with my GM to understand what the industry operates like, what are the unit economics, what are the gross margins, how do you improve gross margins. And you know, I think that is where sometimes your family bails you out. You know, my son said, you think you'll create X value by putting in 4 years in this business, but with so much capital, right? For a fraction of this capital, possibly 1/100th of this capital, with equivalent effort, you can still create this value in the tech space if you put your mind to it. So I think you have to decide where you want to put your mind at. And I think that immediately the decision was made. You know, it's a beautiful property. It's the only vegetarian 5-star banqueting property in the country. Had a vision, but tough call, but, you know, it was okay. I think it was the right thing to do. Probably entered a wrong industry.
Yeah, I guess it comes back to that circle of competence wala part, right? As your son rightly pointed out, the same effort put into tech, because that's where your compounding has happened, that's what you're really good at, can have a significant more value compared to real estate, this was the first time you were technically getting into something like this, right?
Yeah, first and the only time.
So. Yeah. As somebody who's, you know, when we bonded after Vipassana, the common topic that we spoke about when I was talking about the podcast and the thesis that we have, where, you know, most of the media is focused on venture capital and the fundraising news and stuff like that, we wanted to focus more on these profitable businesses. I think I could see something flick inside you where you were like, you know, that is a thesis that I resonate with. So I want to talk to you more about, in this journey that you've lived over the 30 years, the professional journey that you've lived, you've gone on to raise venture capital money. You've come out of it. You've built profitable businesses. How do you think about venture capital money?
I think it's necessary. It's the fuel that keeps the industry going. Okay, I'll give you a parallel, right? A lot of this research that has gone into astrophysics and astronomy and space research has resulted into a lot of improvements in medical diagnosis systems. Right? and has often not even found use in the aerospace or the space technology space. So for me, a lot of the innovation, a lot of the venture capital money, which is a lot of the high risk capital that gets into problem solving and development of new industry paradigms and new thought processes. While some of those venture, you know, so I think the survival percentage is about 10, 12, probably on the outside 13%, if I read the reports correctly. 87% fall by the wayside. But they end up creating a lot more intelligent entrepreneurial skill sets. So, jisse hum Hindi bolte hain, akal khate mein bahut paisa jata hai. I don't call this money as waste. Often it is, but more often than not, it helps create an entire breed of people that have come out more knowledgeable and probably will do something better the next time around. That is one. The other thing is, some of these companies fail, but they leave behind ideas. And if I look at it at a smaller scale, let's look at Gemlinks, right? Gemlinks failed as a company, but the idea in its different shape and form has now reached an unimaginable scale, even a scale that we did not imagine at that time. So it found the right entrepreneur who was willing to take up the basics industry together, probably learn from the Gemlinks mistakes, improve on it, and then get venture capitalists to now say, this idea has already been worked on and I'm doing it better. But hota kya hai ki, you know, in many other industries or in like many other fields, like you look at, you know, retail investor in a stock market, when the going is good, you'll always see that the percentage of people who are participating in retail trade goes on increasing. So many new boutique venture capital firms come up, transaction advisory services come up. Then the quality of research, the valuation of the actual business plan, the business proposal, right? If one person has invested in a, let's say, a online pharmacy, five other funds are starting to look at that as a space. And by the time the sixth or the seventh deal comes to the table, I think the research goes for a whack, right? And that's when I think failures start to creep in. You compromise on the quality of the plan, you compromise on the quality of processes, you compromise on the quality of the people, just because you want to be in that space. Right. So I think it's a very important pillar of the tech industry, for that matter, social engineering industry, the education industry, different industries that need adequate growth capital, where entrepreneurs who have the skill set and the commitment to make that idea work do not have access to the capital. They will never be able to get to market without that venture capital money. But not every entrepreneur can be as successful, not every idea can be as well executed, and not every venture capital money can be good money for that particular entrepreneur mindset. So look at housing.com. Great people, great initial run-up, a sorry story at the end, right? Great courtship, bad marriage. So fund, great fund on board, great set of intelligent people, right? But a mismatch in the boardroom in terms of where they want to take the company. You'll otherwise find some companies where the same fund has put in series 1, series 2, series 3. Great match. May not be a big fund, but they still believe in the industry. They believe in the team. They bond well. So it's not just, you know, I think it's very unidimensional to think venture capital money. It's as unidimensional as thinking a boy looking for a girl for marriage, right? And I think that's where we need to, you know, find out. It could be as simple as values. You know, I have to tell you that, and I thank Sudhir Sethi, who was the director at Walden India when he invested. And, you know, even before the investment term sheet, he told me, you know, you'll have to move the company to Bangalore and Bombay. And the term sheet was right on the table. And I said, Sudhir, there's no way I'm moving. This is the beginning and the end of this discussion, that Indore is where I'm going to be. And Indore is where I have already decided my career is going to be. If that wasn't the case in 97, I wouldn't have gone out and hired a professional CEO or somebody to run the company in the US. I would have moved. Maybe the future of Diaspora could have been different had I moved. But it didn't matter, because you make certain personal choices. Now, if I hadn't said that, or if he hadn't asked that, maybe 6 months down the road, and particularly since WebDunia went through a tough times with its investors because of the dot-com burst, if this point had come up, possibly it could have led to a conflict. I'm glad he brought it up. I'm glad I replied. And he understood my position. So, you know, who is your VC? What is your communication channel? How transparent you are with each other in terms of expectation? And I think there are many VCs that are what I call all-weather VCs. And there are many entrepreneurs that are all-weather entrepreneurs. They're not just looking to, you know, for some entrepreneurs, it's about, you know, how much value I have today, then tomorrow, then day after, and it's that one-way steep rise, right? There's nothing wrong with each approach, right? We are all, the beauty of human race is that we are all unique, right? And we are entitled, you know, by nature to carry on our uniqueness into our lives. So it's a matter of finding the right fit for your uniqueness.
The other thing that I wanted to talk about since we met right after Vipassana, how do you view spirituality in business? How have you married these two concepts together in your life?
Interesting. I think the impact is subtle. Most often it is subtle. And sometimes it is obvious. I think when you are a better person, you are a better manager. And I think and probably we'll someday do a different short story on, you know, the Vipassana and its impact on business life. And for those that are interested on this podcast, I think there is Vipassana in Business is a CD that's available, and maybe you can reach out to Siddharth or myself and we'll be happy to share with you. But, you know, I think in times of the tough decision making, it gives you the inner courage to say, you know, it's not the end of the road. You know, let me walk it. If today I can walk only two steps, let me take those two steps. Someday I'll get the runway to fly. So you know, I think in business also, patience is a great virtue to have. And your belief system, and in my case, that belief system is spirituality, gives you that bit of patience. And, you know, that bit of adherence to the belief that this too shall pass. And I think somewhere also, other than spirituality, what helps me here, and I know the topic is on spirituality, is that my grandfather started Naidunia when he was 40 years old. He did not have money. I know as a worldly possession of a vehicle, the only vehicle he ever owned was a bicycle. I'll call it a means of transport, cannot even call it a vehicle, right? But he created a brand called Naidunia, which has become very synonymous with the city of Indore. So you realize that while you mentioned that resources are important, what I learned from my grandfather is that trusted manpower and manpower that in turn trusts you is bigger than any material resource. If your integrity and concern for the people in a very transparent way gives them the belief that you are there for them, and you will think of them before you think of yourself.
I know you went through some hard times when the funding was getting pulled out from Web Dunia, and the people that stuck along with you during those times. I think this goes on to show, you know, what you're talking about, the trust that people had in you and the trust that you had in people to survive those difficult times.
Yeah, you know, so when I came back and from US, where the IFC told us we're not putting in the second tranche, we gathered all of them for a cup of coffee. There were already 300 employees in Web Dunia. And I said, you know, the plug has been pulled. We don't have money anymore. It doesn't matter. We are better off than those that never raised a second round. So at least IFC money helped us go through the first large phase of not having the money as second round, which a lot of people did not have and have had to wind up. The second thing I said is, for the next 3 months, it is very unlikely we will be able to pay salaries in time because we don't have money. But the moment we break even, we'll ensure the moment we have a cash break even and a cash flow positive, we'll make sure all the back salaries are paid. And, you know, those of you who feel that this is not for you, feel free to leave. We'll settle your money, including notice period salaries, when we have the money. Nobody left. There are three emails to me, which I keep as treasures, where people said, I live with my family. I actually don't need the money. So for next 6 months, even if you don't pay the salary, it's okay. But I believe in this. I'm with you. So I think that's what you earned. So I was much, you know, so I'm talking 2001, 2002. I was 19 years younger than I am today. But to have earned that trust, I think it's something I'm personally proud of, that, you know, I could instill that confidence in people.
I can imagine. Okay, one last question to close it out. I know you started your career with in your family business and things didn't work out for some reason. And I also know that your son came into the family business, right? The reason I'm going to ask you this question is I've seen this in my network. I've seen this, you know, across different family businesses where there is that clash on the younger generation entering the business and you know, the clash of identity, the clash of freedom and all of that. How did your personal experience impact the journey that you had with your son entering the family business?
It seemed obvious about 5-6 years back that my son would be interested to join Diaspora. His area of interest within Diaspora also seemed reasonably clear, because he was more interested in the product side of the business. And in my mind, there was no conflict. And I think in his mind, there was no conflict. And the situation was slightly different. But you mentioned it right. You know, I have a lot of friends my age who have now their second generation entering into the business. Some of these people have done courses in family managed business from ISB and SPGen and, you know, the IIM's executive programs. And often our topic of discussion over dinner or a coffee is, how do you blend the new generation in, right? And with some of them, I have differences. With some of them, I have agreements. The arguments are not holistically, you know, difference or agreements. We, on some points, I would call, not with some people, with some. I think as a person who has founded a company, you tend to fall in love with the company, but you also tend to fall in love with the way you run the company. And you have to accept the fact that that may not be the way that your next generation will want to run the company. So that immediately leads to the question of who controls. You are somebody who wants to give up control on the face of it, but in a structured way and in a time manner, in a dimension of time or phase of time that you think is right. You have a younger one who is itching to take control, because control is one way he feels that he is now in charge. And it is likely because the younger generation has come here looking at the outside and looking at other startups and entrepreneurs who are independently progressing so well, he's starting to benchmark his progress against that. I'm going to take some time explaining this, because I think it's a very, there are people on the podcast that are hearing this and that are, you know, some of them may be people wanting to get into family businesses. I think this could be a good learning. So the problem with the millennials are this virtue called patience is less, because the entire enterprise environment around them seems to be in a rush. So whether they've built their foundation, they've earned the respect within the company, independent of the way it is functioning, whether as a person they've earned that respect of the other senior management or the shop floor people in the company, they start to demand control. And on the other side, you have people who want to give up control, have a semblance and have marketing face value that I've handed it over to the next generation without actually handing over. So there's a clear gap in what is being communicated and what is actually existing on ground. And I think that is where the conflicts begin. So I think if there is a clear communication that if you are entering the family business, this is a phase manner in which we will go. This is year one, year two, year three. Let's be realistic that this is not a startup environment, and let it be very clear. You cannot fix what is not broken. So don't be in a rush to do that. Let's work on things that really need to be fixed, which is where you can fix and earn respect. And I think often, kahin na kahin ye samvad khatam hone lag jata hai. Pita ko dar lagne lagta hai ki maine bete ko ye bol diya ki yaar tera abhi control nahi hai, to bhag jayega. Bete ko ye lagta hai main kar to lungu, par papa ko bura nahi lagna chahiye. So I think when you say it is family managed business, right? So it is family business. And I think family comes first. At a family level, you need to be clear. So in my case, the way we've tried to do it is that the moment my son started to demonstrate his liking for product as the business, within the business, we, and in tech space, it is easier. In manufacturing space, it is not so easy. We started to compartmentalize to the point that we are actually separating out the product business in itself and saying, okay, now you own it, you run it. In 4 years, you've come to a point where you might as well own this piece of the business. You take responsibility for its business plan. I come in as an advisor. It is my responsibility to advise you. If you don't like it, fine, you know, so be it. It was easier because of the space. But let's say you're in the manufacturing industry. What do? I guess role definition. Inside the organization, you start to treat your next generation like any other regular senior employee. Do the KRAs, do the KPIs. Make it clear that those are the KPIs. And his KPIs are more aggressive compared to a regular CXO because he is to be fast-tracked into the leadership. I think if the understanding is clear, it should work out.
Yeah. Yeah. I think the biggest piece that's missing from whenever I have these discussions from my friends, and these are people who are getting into family businesses, is the communications piece. That communication line between the, you know, the elder generation and the younger generation, more often than not, seems broken. And it's not broken because of business. It's broken because of how the relationship has evolved over the years.
If there's a child in the family that has habits that are different from parents, I think parents have to have the wisdom to accept, that these are my value systems. These are his value systems. These are my habits. These are his habits or her habits. Very difficult. You know, in traditional business families, very difficult to train yourself to do that. But I think I'm lucky. You know, I'm lucky in a sense that a lot of my son's friends discuss their business problems and personal problems with me. And sometimes discussing with them gives me an insight into how should I structure or not structure my communication with my son. Because I think all of them can come back to be a part of my family interactions. So we tend to have a very friendly relationship. I think what we've decided is let's not be judgmental about each other. I accept you as you are, as who you are, and you accept me as who I am. If there are nuances to our personalities, let's laugh them out with a good sense of humor. And let's accept the fact that, communication is our biggest wealth in this relationship. So I think he's very clear in telling me, and those are things that I've never reacted to when he tells me that, you know, Baba, if you, you know, this is not good because it'll end up, making me hide things. So it's better that you accept that this is wrong, but I'm doing it. Then my not sharing with you because you'll feel bad about it. So stop feeling bad about it.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it.
Yeah, so it's like that. So and I think that's a bit of learning as parents we have to do.
Makes sense. All right, we'll close it out now. Thank you so much for this very candid conversation of how your entire career has progressed, the ups and downs, the successes, the failures, and the work that you've done. And you continue to do some amazing work. Thank you so much for taking time out, and thank you so much for sharing your journey.
So I will end of the conversation only say one line. Career is just one more variable in the journey called life. Don't make it be all and end all of your life. Enjoy life and career. Don't link the enjoyment of your life with how successful or how unsuccessful your career is. I think those are two different compartments of life. If you follow that, you learn to live happily in life, independent. And I think for me, the biggest aspiration of a life is to find joy.
Yeah, I'm 100% in agreement with that. Thank you so much.